So I'll talk about two effects that have to do with a more realistic neutron star model rather than just taking a fluid ball. I'll talk about what happens when you actually take into account the fact that neutron stars have crusts. And in the spirit of increasing complexity just a little bit, I'll first start with thinking of a neutron star as just liquid in a hard bucket, and then relax that a little bit and say what happens when you actually take into account that the crust of the neutron star is not very rigid, and in fact it's very wobbly. So this is work done with Lars Bilfind and Yuri Levin just in the last few months. So first of all, let me go back to Lee's talk yesterday and emphasize, I'll try to highlight, why is the R-mode instability in purely fluid stars so strong? Or the other way to put it is, why is the shear viscous damping time so long? So basically the onset of the instability is determined by the competition between the gravitational wave growth time and the viscous dissipation time. And as was first shown by Lee Lindblom, Ben Owen, and Sharon Morsink, the gravitational wave growth time for these modes is very, very short. It's roughly 50 seconds for a spin of 1 kilohertz. And what it has to compete with in the case of a purely fluid, in the more simple case, is just sheer viscosity in the fluid. That is, there's differential motion in an R mode, both in the angular direction, where there are these large-scale vortex-looking flows in the star, and in the radial direction, where the radial dependence of the transverse displacement roughly goes as r to the l, and the shear leads to dissipation as, say, neutrons hit each other inside the fluid. And the way to look at it, one way to look at it, is to estimate the total rate of loss of energy throughout the star. And so it scales as the square of this velocity shear, where delta v is the velocity perturbation. And the coefficient that determines that is just the viscosity, kinematic viscosity. And neutron stars turn out to be quite viscous, even superfluid ones. So for comparison, terrestrial materials like water has a viscosity of 10 to the minus 2, but neutron star matter has a viscosity about a million times higher than this. And the other point to notice is that the time scale for shear damping goes as 1 over the length scale of the shear. So for the shear in the fluid R mode, the length scale is roughly the radius of the star, both in the radial direction and in the transverse direction, and in the horizontal direction. And so this leads to rather long viscous damping times of roughly, say, 10 to the 7 seconds for shear viscosity. And so in the interior of the star, it's really true that you can do the dynamics in the inviscid case, just forget about viscosity, and then take it into account afterwards by just looking at the overall dissipation rates. And so when you do that, Lee showed a plot similar to this yesterday. So here, what's plotted is a function of the temperature of the star, which is taken to be the same everywhere. We plot the spin frequency at which the gravitational wave growth time is equal to the dissipation, is equal to the viscous dissipation time. And this part of the curve is determined by the shear viscosity. This part of the curve is something different. We won't concentrate on that. But basically, if you take just standard numbers for the shear viscosity of neutron star fluid, what happens is the frequency for the onset of the instability is very short, or is very small. It's roughly a few hundred hertz at the core temperature of 10 to the 8. And while that's great for spinning down newborn neutron stars, it actually conflicts some observations of accreting neutron stars that Andrew just talked about. So what he showed is the range of the spins. So, you know, in the ball, roughly taking into account this factor of two uncertainty, maybe between 300 and 600. And we can actually estimate the central temperatures of these systems. And just taking a generous range of between 10 to the 8 and 10 to the 9, these guys lie about a factor of 2 above just the pure fluid, about the critical frequency for our modes and purely fluid stars. So the shear viscosity has to actually be about a factor of 300 more to raise this curve up to here. The other constraint that comes from observation of a couple of old millisecond pulsars. So there are a few 1.5 millisecond pulsars that are around. And this was pointed out by Anderson et al. For millisecond pulsars, we actually don't know the central temperatures all that well. We can place some sanity limits. We can say they're less than 10 to the 8. So really, this is just an upper limit. So these guys could be all the way over here and maybe stable. But if these pulsars were indeed spun up in an accreting system when the core temperature was in the ballpark of 10 to the 8 or a few by 10 to the 8, then they must have traveled through this part of the diagram. So there is something not quite right with this picture. And as Greg Mandel talked about yesterday, so you can look at superfluid damping in the interior of the star, but that probably doesn't help raise this curve in most situations. So let's look at what happens when you include a solid crust. So neutron stars actually have crusts. They have liquid cores, which I've cut off here. But then on top of a liquid core, there is a layer that's a few kilometers thick that is the crust. So depending on the equation of state, the thickness of the crust is about 10 to 20% of the radius. So for canonical, for the fiducial 10 kilometer neutron star, the thickness is roughly 1 to 2 kilometers. The crust is made out of heavy nuclei, and the melting temperature is basically set by the competition between the Coulomb energy of the lattice and KT, and just the thermal energy. And throughout the crust, the melting temperature is roughly less than 10 to the 10 K. So for most of the systems that we're interested in, the crusts are actually solid. And what happens when liquid is flowing past the solid body is at the interface between the liquid and the solid, when the liquid is viscous, there can be no difference in transverse velocity. That is what has been assumed. If you assume that the fluid is inviscid, then if you plot the transverse velocity in our mode as a function of radius. So here's the top of here's the surface of the star. Here's the crust core boundary. In the core, if you have just a purely fluid our mode, the displacement, the transverse velocity grows as r to the l. In the crust doesn't move. And if you don't take into account viscosity, then there could be a jump in the transverse velocity. Nothing stopping velocity from jumping discontinuously from zero to some large value. But however, when the fluid is viscous, this velocity has to smoothly go to zero. And so even though the viscosity is not important anywhere inside the star, it actually has to be important near the interface. And so what is the thickness of the layer where viscosity is important? Well, that's just standard boundary layer theory. So if you schematically write down the fluid equation, so here's the acceleration of the fluid element, here's the Coriolis force, so omega is the spin of the star and delta V is the velocity of the fluid element, here's the pressure gradient, and here's the viscosity term that goes as the gradient of the velocity shear, then first let's forget about the Coriolis force, then to estimate the width of the boundary layer, we just compare the acceleration to the viscosity, and imagining that the shear is over length scale delta, unfortunate choice of letters, then you get that roughly the width of the boundary layer is the ratio of the kinematic viscosity to the mode frequency. If you look at the balance between the Coriolis force and the shear force in the boundary layer, then you get that the width of the layer is roughly ratio of the viscosity to spin frequency. But for the R modes, the spin frequency is roughly equal to the mode frequency. So while if you take Coriolis force into account, the Ekman problem gives you a somewhat different width of the boundary layer and definitely different angular dependence of the velocity in the boundary layer. The difference in the damping rate is a factor of order unity. It's a few. And so, but the interesting part is that the width of the boundary layer is actually very small. It's just a few centimeters at a temperature of 10 to the 8, and at higher temperatures, it's even smaller. So the length scale over which the shear acts is not the radius of the star, but it's centimeters. And so, therefore, the shear is much stronger, and the dissipation time is much shorter. In fact, the dissipation time is so short that if I redo the same plot, with the boundary layer viscosity, what I get is a curve over here. That is the R mode instability in a neutron star with a crust will set in only for spin frequencies above this line. And so the range in this plot is the range of lines in this plot is just comes about from changing the viscosity somewhat. And actually, you can do a more careful job of looking at the different equation of state, and also exploring the dependence of the frequency for the onset of the instability on the density at the cross core boundary. And so, on this plot, what's shown is the temperature at which the R mode instability sets in a maximally rotating star as a function of the density at the cross core boundary. So the fiducial density at the cross core boundary for the latest results is roughly 1.5 by 10 to the 14 grams per centimeter cube. And so basically for a maximally rotating neutron star, it's gotta be hotter then some temperature in this range, in the interesting range of 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 9, for the instability to be even important. So, however, there are caveats, and now I'll go through the caveats. First of all, so you have this fluid going back and forth, rubbing against the crust. One thing you can worry is that as it rubs against the crust, it can drag the crust along. And you can ask, well, how much can it drag it along? Because really the efficiency of the boundary layer depends on the velocity jump between the crust and the core. And so you can basically compare the shear stress, that is the force per unit area applied by the fluid to the crust, with the elastic response of the crust. You can ask how much does the crust over here need to bend in order to match the force applied to it by the fluid. And just estimating that, you get that it's a small number, and it's actually interesting because it depends on the ratio of the boundary layer width to the radius of the star. So that's a small number, that's roughly 10 to the minus 5, but it scales as 1 over the rigidity of the crust. So mu is the shear modulus of the crust, which I will come back to in a second. And this number is roughly 10 to the 2 to 10 to the 3. So this is a small number for the standard value of the shear modulus. However, if the crust is not very rigid, this number grows. And so so this can potentially become large for a very floppy or a very, very floppy crust. So here what actually, let me come back and say what actually I plotted. So here, what actually this describes is the ratio of the transverse displacement in the crust to the to radius compared to the transverse displacement of the fluid in the core divided by the radius. So alpha is the mode amplitude. It basically is the ratio of the transverse displacement in the core to the radius. And so when this number is small, what this means is the crust is basically static versus the core is moving quite happily. So, but however, how rigid is the crust? And the rigidity of the crust, or the shear modulus in the crust, is basically because it's a Coulomb solid, that is their nuclei with some charge arranged in a lattice, and roughly the shear modulus is proportional to the Coulomb energy density of this lattice, and so the ratio of that to the pressure can be expressed is roughly 1% in the outer crust where there are no drip neutrons, and in the inner crust it actually becomes smaller because most of the stuff are just neutrons floating around, and so it's roughly a number of 10 to the minus 2 to 10 to the minus 3. So the way to think about it is that the crust is very rigid stuff. It has a very high bulk modulus, but it's very floppy, kind of like, so it doesn't resist bending very much. So it's more like jello than a regular solid, like that board. And so if you look at the pulsation equations in the crust, so I wrote them down schematically over here. So this is the acceleration term, where omega is the frequency of the mode. Here's the elastic force, and here's the Coriolis force. And here I just wrote the displacements. The displacements have time dependence of e to the I omega t. So when you take derivatives, you just bring down I omega. So first, forget about the rotation for a minute and look at just modes. If you look at just modes in a non-rotating crust, then to estimate the frequency, you just compare the acceleration to the elastic force, and in the crust, there are modes that look just like the R modes in the core. That is, they're just these torsional oscillations, and their frequency for the fundamental mode, that is the mode that has no wiggles in the radial dependence, is roughly 50 hertz. And so now you can go back and say and do exactly what Dong did yesterday in comparing the magnetic field effect on the R mode. You can apply the same reasoning to the effect of the shear modulus. So you basically compare these two terms, and the ratio of the shear force to the Coriolis force gives you the frequency shift of the R mode when you have both elastic forces and rotation, and it's basically given by the ratio of the mode and the mode frequency in the non-rotating star to the frequency of the R mode when there is no elastic, where there is no shear modulus squared. So if this is 50 hertz and this is a few hundred hertz, then for large spins, you can see that Coriolis force really dominates the dynamics. It's not the elasticity that calls the shots, but the Coriolis force. So the other way to think about it is the following. The shear modulus of the crust is very small. So let's go to the opposite limit. Imagine that the shear modulus is zero, so it's a liquid. Then there is no issue with elasticity, and the entire star just moves together. You have one big R mode going around. Now imagine, so then what you would expect is the radial dependence of the displacement will be R to the L throughout the star. However, now imagine turning on the shear modulus just a little bit. So the crust is almost a liquid, but not quite. So it's going to move just a little bit differently than the solid. So there is going to be a velocity jump between the liquid and the solid. But it's not going to be as severe as if the crust was completely rigid, where the velocity would jump from some value to zero. And so what one would expect is that this jump, the fractional amplitude of this jump is roughly the ratio of the shear force to the Coriolis force, where it's again this number. So actually the things turned out to be more complicated than this, but before I go into that, what kind of effect does this have on the boundary layer damping time, that is on the damping time scale that was 100 seconds if you assume that the crust was rigid? Well, basically that damping time is proportional to the velocity jump or slippage squared, and so this this number is typically about 100 to 1,000 that one has to calculate, and I'll show you how we did it. But that means that the frequency for the onset of the instability, which goes as roughly the sixth root of this number, for 10 to the 3, for this number being 10 to the 3, it goes up by a factor of 3, or goes down by a factor of 3, rather. So how do you compute this velocity mismatch? Well, for an R mode with L equals M, the leading order displacements are toroidal. They just look like one of those vortex patterns. But however, if you go to next order in the spin frequency, there is a part of the mode that looks more like a G mode, that has radial displacements, and it has a spheroidal angular displacements. And on the other hand, in the crust, there are both toroidal modes and spheroidal modes. That is, they're shear waves that have radial displacements, and they're torsional modes. And when you include the angular velocity, those two kinds of modes are actually coupled, just like they are in the liquid part of the star. However, so now you have these two oscillators. You have the liquid core that has this kind of angular dependence, and you have the solid crust that also has the radial motion in some of these modes. And if you set them oscillating together, the radial motion in one is going to push on the other. So in some sense, the core pushes the crust up and down. And the two oscillators are coupled, even if there is no viscosity. And so that's really the crucial point that provides the boundary condition that changes everything. So the mode, for a constant density, for a barotropic star that's purely fluid, there is only one L equals M R mode. There is the mode that goes as R to the L in the crust, however, as R to the L in the liquid. However, there are many modes in the core. There are many modes in the crust. There is one mode in the core. Sorry. And when you couple these two systems, what you expect is to get the system with many modes. And so that's exactly what we get. So what we did is calculated the mode spectrum for a star with constant density and constant shear modulus in the crust, and we varied the thickness of the crust to be either 10% or 20% of the total size of the star to kind of see what happens. And so here, here's the dispersion relation. Here's function of the spin frequency in dimensionless units, where this is roughly the breakup. This is roughly the breakup spin. We plotted the mode frequency again in those units. Let's first look at the zero frequency limit. So there are many modes, as you can see. These are all crustal modes. This is this fundamental toroidal mode that I talked about, the one that has the frequency of 50 hertz. These are other modes with zero crossings in the angular in the radial dependence. They have higher frequencies because basically the frequency of the mode goes as one over the wavelength. And this guy is the R mode. It's the zero frequency limit of the R mode. So, and as you can see, as you increase the frequency, these modes get affected by rotation, and they go through avoided crossings. So, let me show you some eigenfunctions to maybe make it more clear. So first I'm going to look at the modes right here at zero frequency. I'm going to look at these two guys. So, So here what's plotted is again this transverse displacement as a function of the radius. And so this picture is for this mode over here. So it's an R mode with a solid crust. However, it's at a small frequency. And so it's a liquid in the bucket. You have this R squared dependence inside the liquid core. And then it drops to zero in the crust. So it's really the picture that I talked about before. And here's this guy is this mode over here. And the velocity in the crust is zero. The number here is 600 because it's actually normalized to be one over here. But clearly, there's no motion in the core, and all the motion in the crust is in the crust. And there are no nodes in the radial dependence. But now let's look at these same two modes over here at the frequency of 0.07 of breakup. So now what happens is the two modes kind of switch character. This guy has some motion in the crust, and this guy has a lot of motion in the core. Like the motion in the core in these two modes is comparable, and the way that it's normalized to be the same value over here. Okay, so if you look further down this diagram, now compare. Now I'm going to look at the modes, at the two modes over here, and then over here. And you can really see how the properties of the modes interchange through this avoided crossing. So before the avoided crossing, this was a mode with a lot of motion in the crust, and this was a mode with a zero crossing in the crust. So here's zero. So this has a zero crossing. This doesn't. And after the avoided crossing, their properties interchange. That is, there is a zero crossing here, and there is no zero crossing over here. And this mode looks more or less like the limit where the shear modulus of the crust is very small. That is, everything moves roughly like as a liquid, but there is a little bit of a mismatch. And so that's the general picture of displacements. But what's of course interesting is now to find this jump as a function of frequency. And so that's what's plotted in the bottom panel for a model with a thick crust. So here, for this mode that starts out as an R mode with a non-moving crust and then has an avoided crossing, here is the mismatch in velocity between the crust and the core, and it's roughly constant because the crust never really moves. For this mode that started out as a crustal mode with no motion in the core, but then had an avoided crossing and became really an R mode-like mode. At first, at small spin frequency, the motion is all in the crust, no motion in the core, so the mismatch is large. But then as it has an avoided crossing, the mode starts penetrating the crust, and the relative motion between the crust and the core becomes small. However, what happens here, as it goes through another avoided crossing, it's this mode that becomes the R mode, or something that looks like an R mode throughout, versus this mode starts looking more like a crustal mode again. So the slip velocity between the crust and the core has this complicated dependence for each of the modes. But of course, what we're interested in is the mode with the smallest relative velocity, because the damping time goes as the relative velocity squared, or rather, sorry. So the damping rate goes as the relative velocity squared. And so the mode that has the smallest frequency for the onset of the instability has the smallest relative motion, has the smallest slippage. And so here, so basically you have to pick the mode as function of the frequency. At small frequency, it will be this mode. But then once you go past the frequency where the crustal mode frequency is equal to the spin, then the character switches and it really becomes this mode that is the most unstable. And then once you go through this avoided crossing, it's this mode it's not as unstable, but clearly the dispersion relation for the R mode is just the mode frequency is two-thirds the spin frequency in the rotating frame, and that's roughly the line, this line. So basically, the mode that has the frequency closest to just the regular R mode is the one that has the one that has the smallest slippage, and that's easy to understand because when you're close to the mode, to the R mode frequency, then the Coriolis force is what's doing the doing the restoring in this situation. So for comparison, here's the same picture but for a thinner crust, and what happens in a thinner crust is there are less modes. Because to fit a certain number of wiggles in the crust, you really need, it's really less energetically favorable for a thin crust because you need a larger wavelength, or you need a smaller wavelength. And so over here, there is no avoided crossing in this spin frequency range. Instead, the first avoided crossing comes near breakup. And so the slippage or the relative velocity is just a small number throughout. And so that becomes a crucial, that becomes a crucial difference when you look at the instability curve. So again, here I plotted the core temperature and the frequency for the onset of instability. So this is the pure fluid line. This is the line where the crust is rigid. And here now are the instability lines for a thin crust and for a thicker crust. And so this line is really funny because it basically reflects the non-monotonic shape of the relative motion between the crust and the core. And but how do you interpret these lines in terms of where is the mode unstable? Well, it's always unstable to the right of the instability line, to the right of this line. So what you got to think about is the temperature for the instability rather than the frequency for the instability. So let me close by saying that obviously what we've done is just a very simple constant density model, and it's not clear whether one can get any value for the relative velocity between the crust and the core if you include more physics in the crust, or whether there's some preferred range. The other important issues are. For example, can a magnetic field really tie the crust to the core? Because what we've shown here is that just the mechanical coupling can tie the crust to the core for all the spin frequencies. But there may be other mechanisms that could. The one uncertainty that I want to highlight, however, is the shear modulus in the crust. So we've assumed that the transition between the crust and the core is sharp. That is, in basically in no distance whatsoever, the crust goes from having non-zero shear modulus to zero, to liquid. And actually, I don't know the answer to this, but if there is some length scale over which the shear modulus goes from some value to zero, then if this transition from crust to core happens on even in the range of density of 4×10⁴, that means that the thickness of this transition is 10 centimeters, roughly 10 centimeters, which is on the old order of the thickness of the boundary layer. So I don't think that even the density of the cross-core transition is known to this accuracy. And the issue here is not really whether the stuff on the crust is molten or not, but the issue here is how gradual is the disappearance of the nuclei between the crust and the core. So what happens in the crust, as you go to higher and higher density, the nuclei become bigger and bigger, and the Coulomb energy is not just a formula given for a point particle. Instead, it has a term that comes about because nuclei have finite size. So here, if Rn is the size of a nucleus and Rc is the separation, then as nuclei grow to fill the entire space, of course the Coulomb energy becomes zero, and so the shear modulus also becomes zero. And so I'd love to know the answer of whether this transition is sharp or not. So maybe somebody could just say it.
All right. Thanks, great.
Okay.
I can't drive a question. What's the outer crust doing?
Does it move or not, or?
What happens, what's its role, if any? What's going to happen in the outer crust?
In terms of, just in terms of motion?
Yeah.
Or? Well, are you worried about the viscous dissipation there between the crust and the ocean?
Maybe, or what is the displacement? Would the displacement in the outer crust be important? Would it be cracking or anything like that?
So the amplitude for cracking is easy to estimate. Roughly, the strain angle in the crust is roughly just the mode amplitude. So, but of course, nobody can really tell you with any much certainty what the breaking amplitude is. You know, the range is from 10^-2 to 10^-5. So if you imagine that the core mode, the core is strongly coupled, if you're in the regime where the core is strongly coupled to the crust, that is, the amplitudes are comparable, then the crust would crack at the mode amplitude of 10^-2, 10^-3, 10^-4, whatever you assume for the breaking strain.
But the effect of the outer crust on the effective viscosity is negligible.
I guess I'm not entirely full. Maybe I'm not caffeinated enough yet. So,
essentially, you've neglected the effect of the outer crust.
Well, we took a with
the inner crust before. Now, will the outer crust have any effect on the effective?
Right. So we did not look at any dissipation between the outer crust and the liquid. That's right. We just took a boundary condition that's basically a free surface boundary condition. No. Okay. Got us. So, right. So for an outer mode amplitude of a tenth, the strain in the crust is also roughly a tenth. Apart for the right, a tenth. But I would argue that 1/100th is not unrealistic. Right, 10^-2 is not unrealistic. Right, but that does tell you that. Yeah. Lee? So when the crust in the regime where the crust is moving almost like a liquid, then the strain in the crust is roughly just the mode amplitude. Of course, in the regime, so. All right, so if you're in this part of the curves, right? If you're in this part of the curve where the crust is acting almost like a liquid, then the strain in the crust is also just the same as the deformation of the liquid. That is roughly the mode amplitude. Well, no, it breaks. It would break. Lee?
When you did the stability curve, you showed the critical angular velocities function of temperature. When you calculated the gravitational radiation time scale that went into that, did you actually use the real eigenfunctions for these modes, or did you just use the standard R?
Right. So we cheated. We didn't take into account the motion of the crust. The reason we didn't do that is because all we had...
So much. Core part of the eigenfunctions for these actual modes are much different than the standard.
Well, so the core when you're close to the R mode frequency, then the correction to the eigenfunction in the core is actually small. Basically, when the frequency is close to just the regular 2/3 of omega, all of those corrections are small.
So I thought these graphs showed the eigenfunctions, they look very different.
Well, in fact, so in fact, the displacement on the core, where the cell equals 2 node, always goes as R squared. And it's always normalized to have unity amplitude. It's always normalized so that it will have the same amplitude here as an R mode with a unit amplitude that filled the entire star. But of course, the relative motion, the relative amplitude is different. And that's actually true. And so the correction that come about because the frequency of the mode is not 2/3 are small when you're close to that frequency. And so in the core, we actually did not include those corrections in the crust. Where, so another way to put it is another way to put it is this. So for a purely fluid R mode, this ordering is right. And so in the liquid, we actually assumed this ordering. But in the crust, we did not assume this ordering. It depends on the mode amplitude, and Yanchen is going to talk about that.
And
Ben is going to talk about it too. Yes.
At the boundary, you are assuming that there is no that there is free slipping of the core with the
crust. Right. That's right, and so that's probably justified just by considering that estimate of the viscous drag over the viscous force exerted by the fluid motion on the crust, and that leads to small displacements. So just because the viscosity is so small, even though the core really rubs against the crust, it doesn't pull it very much compared to the shear modulus. Right. Right, but the viscosity is really small. So the estimate is just this. So if you look at the shear stress, that is, there is some shear in the fluid that acts on the length scale of the width of the boundary layer. So then the stress, the force per unit area that you apply to the crust, is just this. And then you ask, well, how much does the crust have to displace in order to generate the same in order to match that stress? And the displacement is small when the shear modulus is a reasonable value. So in the core, what happens?